It's Thursday, December 2nd, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The recent effort to legalize the sale and possession of a small amount of marijuana in the state of California may have failed back in November, but the issue is anything but off the screen. As a matter of fact, efforts to legalize marijuana not only in the state of California, but in other states and across the nation continue, aided and abetted by the fact that there are many, especially in the baby boom generation, who think of marijuana as really not a drug or a narcotic at all. But there's more than meets the eye going on here. For instance, the Washington Monthly, a very interesting magazine that offers investigative reports, looks at the fact that life in California as related to marijuana isn't exactly as might first appear. In order to prove the point, the reporter goes to Mendocino County, a place defined in the article as one of the most beautiful in America. However, a place where a good deal of the economy is actually driven by marijuana. Now get this. The reporter writes, "I'd always known that pot was a huge part of the county's livelihood, accounting for 2/3 of the local economy by some estimates." End quote. Now that is a remarkable statement. Mendocino County, along with Humboldt County, are thought to derive a good deal of their actual economic strength from the illegal growing, harvesting, and sale of marijuana. Now, one of the things that makes this particular story in the Washington Monthly so interesting is that the legalization of marijuana is considered by many throughout California as a threat to this particular way of life. Now, you have to understand something about American cultural history in order to understand what's going on here. It was a large group of those who were basically exiting from the larger culture in the 60s and 70s who went to places like Mendocino County, California, in order to set up something of a communal or at least countercultural existence. Marijuana was front and center to their lifestyle and, of course, also, as it turned out, to the economy. They are big proponents of small and sustainable marijuana growing. You know exactly what they fear. The legalization of marijuana, first of all, takes away the franchise. Secondly, it will almost assuredly lead to the commercialization of the product. And that means not small, sustainable farms, as defined in this article, but large agribusiness taking up marijuana once it is, after all, a legal and legitimate substance. You can also predict another direction where this is headed. As John Gervois, the reporter in this article, suggests, maybe the farmers in Mendocino County, California, will decide that their angle will be organic marijuana. Though not the intended purpose of the Washington Monthly investigative report, one obvious implication of all of this is that the legalization of marijuana will not be a small cultural change. It will be a massive cultural change. And what a nation or a culture legitimizes, it then begins to value. It becomes a matter of the economy. It becomes a matter of taxation. It becomes a matter of the ongoing life of the community, not just in small, sustainable farms where marijuana is a part of rather rural California, but if it's legalized everywhere, including your neighborhood. Moving to the pages of USA Today, reporters Dee Dee Tang and Mary Beth Markline report that schools and public libraries are reporting what they call an uptick of organized efforts to remove books, especially from libraries, but also from curriculum. Now, this is the predictable kind of story that you need to be ready to recognize from time to time. It's the kind of story that is more or less hand-in-hand with the displays you see in local bookstores of what are identified as banned books, even though, when you look closely at the reality, very few, if any, of those books have ever actually been banned. But what the reporters in this USA Today story are trying to argue is that local public libraries and school systems are experiencing not just isolated parents who are complaining about particular books that are offensive, largely, usually, because of sexual content and accusations of pornography, but also for other problematic and troublesome content as well. Now, the absolute determination of groups such as the American Library Association is to keep parents and citizens from having any direct influence on what is or is not in the library. In a very strange turn, a profoundly anti-democratic turn, what you have in many of these library systems and in the public schools is the assumption that somehow there are experts who should decide what does and does not belong in the library. Well, those experts are anything but ideologically neutral. They are given to the kind of agenda that is reflected in the fact that the ALA has recently adopted a new prize given to a book that has to do with gay and lesbian literature for teenagers and young children. This is not a value-neutral situation in which you have literary experts judging books on their literary qualities. No, there's an agenda here, and it's transparent. And a part of this agenda is to keep parents and citizens from having a direct involvement. Now, before you jump too quickly on this issue, we need to recognize that there are certain protections built into the Bill of Rights in terms of what we would expect a public library to possess, to have, and to circulate. After all, we would not expect a public library or any kind of public institution to contain only materials and books with which we would be in agreement. But clearly, there are those that are outside any allowable or acceptable boundary, especially when it comes to children as the users and readers of the books. Now, when you start to think about what's going on in the world of higher education, and in this case, the library world, you have to look at the kind of arguments they offer. And one is going to be cited here precisely because it is ludicrous, somewhat hilarious, and extremely revealing. Judith John, an English professor at Missouri State University, suggested that book bans might have become more noticeable these days, listen to this, because of an uncertain economy and concerns about terrorism. Quote, when people are afraid, they become more conservative and reject changes, end quote. Now, it's perfectly possible for conservatives to use psychobabble to try to interpret liberals. But in this case, you have a classic case of a liberal even more prone to use psychobabble to try to understand conservative concerns. And by the way, there's no objective data supplied here as to whether there actually is an uptick or not. They're just isolated and anecdotal examples given. Most of them, by the way, ones that would concern any, I think, normal parent looking at the materials. But the central ideology here is to protect the librarian's own professional interest in choosing which books are and are not circulated in a library and available for patrons of various ages or all ages. When you're in the bookstore and you see these banned bookweeks displays, look at them carefully and ask those who put the display together, have any of these books actually been banned? As it turns out, most of them have simply been the object of some kind of parental or community complaint. If you want to know what book banning is all about, let's be honest, we know societies that do it, and this is not such a society. Turning to the pages of the Wall Street Journal, Elliot Abrams has a fascinating op-ed column. Mr. Abrams served as Assistant Secretary of State from 1981 to 1989 and as Deputy National Security Advisor to President George W. Bush from 2005 to 2009. He writes his column in the aftermath of the release of about 250,000 American diplomatic documents by WikiLeaks. Now, there's been a good deal of discussion about this, and we have discussed it on the briefing in terms of questions of the morality of knowledge, but there's a different angle that Mr. Abrams takes up, and it's one that, quite honestly, I had not considered until I read his column. He asked if we've noted that most of the interesting columns that have come to attention are about autocratic regimes. They are either cables between American diplomats and diplomats of other nations about these autocratic regimes, or they are direct references and communications with such regimes. Now, there have been, as we now know by looking at the WikiLeaks materials, references to individuals such as French President Nicolas Sarkozy, but by and large, they are about these autocratic regimes. They are marked secret, or top secret, or highly secret. But one of the interesting aspects of all of this, as Mr. Abrams makes clear, is that the secrecy involved in many of these communications is not actually demanded by the United States government in terms of initiation. It is demanded by these autocratic governments. Why? Because what they say to Americans is not what they say to their own citizens. That also leads me to appreciate a recent column that appeared in one of the major British newspapers, and a liberal one at that, suggesting that the review of the materials released by WikiLeaks indicates that the United States says in private basically what it says in public. That in itself is a good reflection upon a government. It is also a statement that can rarely be made of dictatorships, tyrants, and autocracies. Among the many unspeakable atrocities of the Second World War was a massacre of 22,000 Polish officers that took place in the Katyn Forest in 1940. Now, it has long been known that this was a Stalinist exercise undertaken as retribution by the Soviet Red Army. But until recently, until this week, that was not acknowledged in terms of any official acknowledgement or apology from the Russian government to the government of Poland. That came this week, as the Russian government did indeed take this responsibility and by a legislative vote and communicate by Prime Minister Vladimir Putin just before his visit to Poland, the apologies and acknowledgement of this massacre on the part of Stalin and his henchmen. Now, why would this be important in the year 2010? With 2011 about to dawn and World War II now receding further and further into the past, why is an acknowledgement such as this important? It is because history comes with moral imperatives. It is absolutely imperative that we go back to the events of history that are recoverable, especially by those who are alive today, and deal with what actually happened. There has to be a moral accounting. There is something within us as individuals, as societies, even as just basic human beings aware of this kind of horror. There is a desire to see some accounting and some responsibility. Now, Stalin is long dead. There is no way to try him for war crimes, and most of those who were his henchmen in that forest, massacring 22,000 Polish officers, are now in no position to be tried. Most of them are long dead, buried, and forgotten. Christians looking at a story like this should understand that this is an affirmation of the moral sense that God has implanted within every single human being, a part of what it means to be made in the image of God. But far beyond that, an acknowledgement like this and the hollowness of the verdict points to the need for divine justice. This is why we understand that the whole creation is yearning for a judgment that is to come. When the perfect justice of God and His perfect righteousness are displayed before all creation in a way that rectifies every wrong. In the book of Revelation, it's described as that time when every eye is dry and every tear is wiped away. That's only possible because it takes divine justice to set the world aright. The Russian government did the right thing by acknowledging this atrocity, but Joseph Stalin is long dead. He is not now on trial. There will be no accounting in this life, only in the life to come. And that is something that Christians know and understand, and that's why we understand justice as not only a present imperative, but as an eschatological promise. Secular readers reading the newspaper or coming across accounts such as we discussed today will understand them in terms of the news, in terms of politics, culture, and social analysis. But when we read news stories like this, when we read a newspaper, watch the news on the television, look at the news as it streams before us on the internet, we have to be aware that what we are seeing as Christians is deeply, inherently, inescapably, unavoidably theological. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For more information about Southern Seminary, go to sbts.edu. And for information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.